Thank you for joining me for today's 6th CEU seminar regarding building intimacy with couples. I'll be your presenter, Michelle Sparks, LPCC and owner of River of Life Professional Counseling. As we start this seminar today, I'd like to highlight something that I'll probably highlight throughout this seminar. That is, we're talking on this topic of building intimacy with couples, that we're not just talking about physical intimacy or their desire for one another, but we're talking about all the different things that make a relationship between couples successful. For example, if couples don't have good communication, if they don't know how to problem solve, if they are unable to get through conflict successfully, if they don't understand each other, if they don't really understand the rules of fighting fair, and if they don't know what love and connection is to each other, they're not going to be able to progress through their relationship. So as we talk today, just to make sure that you understand going into this, that we're going to be looking at a variety of different tools and topics to explore in terms of how to help our couples build skills that will help them have a successful relationship and be closer. In a 2012 article by Abbott and Snyder, they talked about what are the important aspects that any psychotherapeutic intervention should target in successful marriage or couples counseling. There were several areas they identified. One was looking at their relationship beliefs. We all come in with assumptions and expectations about things. We all have our ways of looking at things and what we attribute to the other, which may or may not be correct. So today in our seminar, we will definitely address that area, the area of expectations and attributions, the areas of just thought patterns and what thought patterns may be helpful and what thought patterns may be hindering relationship. We also will look at, in successful marriage counseling, their relationship experiences and what's brought them to this point, how to build on strengths and things that have worked to this point, as well as how to do some skill building in areas where they may have some deficits. We'll look at their defense mechanisms or their defensive strategies. One of the things that the research tends to show is how people fight, quote unquote, actually can predict the success or the failure of a relationship. That it's not so much that couples that are healthy avoid fighting or avoid discord, but they have a method to deal with it. As we get to the section today on conflict management, one of the things you'll hear me highlight that is often a shock to my clients is that we can actually plan for healthy conflict. We can develop skills. We can proactively have a plan for what to do because there will be conflict. It's unreasonable to think there isn't. And there's personality patterns that each partner brings into the relationship. So we can look at what those are. One of the things that's going to be key is, as we approach today, is learning to think outside the parameters of any one theoretical orientation. We really need to individualize our therapy to the given couple that's coming in. After we hear their narrative, after they share their presenting concerns with us, we really need to pick and choose which of these types of interventions are really going to work best for them, given what they're presenting. So essentially, we're using a pluralistic approach of evidence-based resources. There's more research that looks at what are some of the qualities of a healthy marriage. And so today, we're not just going to look at how to deal with problems in marriage, but we're also going to look at how to build healthy aspects of marriage. Some of these may sound like common sense, but they're worth saying and they're worth discussing with our clients. One of the healthy marriage qualities is to make the relationship a priority. And again, that may sound like common sense, but I've had couples that have come in that were going through a separation because they were having struggles. And one of the things that initially I didn't do right, but over time realized, was that I needed to ask them, how are they really going to plan to practice these exercises we're learning in counseling? Essentially, how are they going to make their relationship a priority? Being that they've already moved apart, being that they've already separated, being that they've already taken a break in some ways from their relationship, and they don't have a regular schedule of seeing and interacting with each other, how are they going to make enough of a priority to practice these skills that they're being taught in counseling? So we can't assume that a couple is really going to make time to do what we're teaching them. We can't assume that they have that time, that they're making that. I'll even ask couples, what does that look like? How many days a week do you think you'll be able to do these things? How will that look? Secondly, healthy marriages also have the element of communicating regularly. There's some system in place, whether it's texts, emails, messages, family meetings. There's some system in place that highlights the importance of the couple getting together, the importance of them sharing about their day. One of the things we'll look at throughout today, and you'll see highlighted by some of the gurus of marriage counseling, is that the best marriages are relationships between two people where there is a foundation of friendship. Friendship requires communication. It requires being around each other so that you continue to grow and learn and work together. And it involves practicing communication. I know the old saying or cliche, practice makes perfect. But it is true that over time, if healthy communication skills, like we're going to talk about today, are practiced, it becomes a little bit more easy to go to them, especially when times are rough. One of the other things we'll look at today is how to be affirming. How to use strengths-based and solution-focused methods to practice encouragement. Oftentimes, couples come to us, obviously, because there are concerns they have and things that appear to be going wrong or not going well. So for that reason, a lot of times they're surprised when I mention, okay, you've been together several months or years. Something must be keeping you together. What has worked for the two of you to this point? One of the biggest problems couples do is a lot of times they only talk when there's problems. They don't talk about solutions and strengths. They don't practice encouragement. They don't make it a regular practice to talk about what goes well. It's a whole lot easier to proactively talk about what's going well and how do we keep that going well than waiting till things become a disaster. So another area that we can look at is them having some kind of quote-unquote schedule of marriage meetings and choices. There needs to be a way for them to get together. We can't assume that that automatically happens. A fifth area that's highlighted in the literature regarding healthy marriage qualities is making sure that they have a method for negotiating, problem solving, deciding what the rules and conflict resolution is. And we'll talk about that in depth today. Now we're going to talk about a lot of skill building. But interestingly enough, the literature also highlights it's important to have regular fun. It's not just about all the work of the counseling and the therapy and the problem solving that we're going to talk about today. But it's important that couples learn how to just be around each other with no agenda, with no problem solving, just to hang out with each other. Oftentimes that's what they were doing in the early stages of dating, but a lot of times they get away from that, whether it be kids are born, work or different schedules, chores, things pull them away. It's very important to discuss with clients, how do they plan to have leisure or fun? And then we'll also talk about another quality of healthy marriages, which is emotional and psychological intimacy. The physical intimacy ultimately comes out of having the emotional and psychological intimacy. John Gottman, we'll refer to him a lot today in literature, talks about how we make marriage work. Part of it is just learning how to do life together, which happens over time. It's important for us to share with our clients that just like it took time for them to get to this point of some of the struggles they're coming in with, it'll take time to learn how to do life together, to learn how to argue, and to learn how to celebrate, to learn how to problem solve, and to learn how to talk about what goes well. It'll take time to learn how to deal with differences of opinion. It's not natural, and it's often not taught in our family of origin, or even before we get to our, marriage, how to have a climate that focuses on listening and hearing each other. And we'll spend a significant amount of today in our seminar in talking about how to share things, how to gently approach each other, how to make behavior requests, how to share just from our point of view rather than accusing or assuming. And then we'll also talk about how the listener on the receiving end should respond. Things like not diving in to correct or debate things, but how to truly hear and listen well. How to really empathize and put ourselves in each other's shoes. One of the neat things that John Gottman highlights in his literature is the importance of creating a climate of learning together. The idea is developing a sense of we and us, that there's a sense of teamwork. Regardless of if it's your fault or my fault, the idea is that we're together facing this stuff that's trying to tear at the foundations of our marriage or our relationship. And we want to learn together. We want to grow. This requires the next point that John Gottman makes, which is having an environment in which it's okay to be vulnerable. And as I said before, being friends. You'd be surprised when I ask couples, how many times do they really believe that their partner has their best interest at heart? How many times they're not sure about that? And that's where that idea of, my partner's still my friend. I really do think they have my best interest at heart. They're there for me. We hang out together. We do fun things together. Making marriage work is a proactive thing. We'll learn about that today. It's not something, hopefully, that people wait till there's problems just to freak out and then try and patch things up. But we can also teach couples how to build on strengths. Now, Madden, in a 2005 article, talks about some key questions that are really important to broach in couples therapy. It's not easy to come in and talk to a stranger or to humble yourself about your problems or your relationship. So the first question that Madden highlights is, how did you even get the courage to talk to a stranger about your relationship? And that's a useful question, because a lot of the answers we often hear have to do with it just reached that point where it was becoming too much. And it's important to hear from our couples what it takes for it to get to the point of too much. For someone, that can happen very quickly. And then for someone else, it takes a whole lot more. Second key question, do you think the problems in the relationship are more to do with things inside the relationship or things outside the relationship? So for example, is it the in-laws? or our work environments, or friends out there weighing in on us? Is it all the bills and stresses of life? Or is it something about us as a couple, in our relationship and in our home that we really need to work through? Another key question is, what do you notice about other relationships that you like or don't like that are similar or unsimilar to your own relationship? This, I think, also touches on the issue of who are your role models. I'll ask couples a variation of this. Was there a time in your relationship where things were going better or more like the way you'd like? And if not so much in your relationship, do you have couples, whether they're someone you know personally or someone that you just admire, that you say, oh, I really like that they do A, B, and C? That gives me a little information, too, about what they believe a healthy marriage is. And another thing we can talk with couples about is, if their relationship improves, what will have changed? What qualities would have changed in each of them individually? What dynamics would change between them in the relationship? Finally, did you learn anything in your family that helps or hinders you in this relationship? And keep in mind that they may have differences of opinion. One might think that something that's a strength in their family background is actually, to the other one, a deficit. I can't tell you how many times I've had couples, for example, that argue about a topic like, who do we spend the holidays with? And one will tell me how their family of origin approached that, and they will believe it's absolutely the best way. And the other one will say, oh gosh, that's so ridiculous. I think this other way is the best way. Sometimes as we're doing couples counseling, that may involve both of them being in the room together, working together on different skills. But oftentimes, they may be doing some individual work alongside things. I think it's really important, as Rosenberger talks about in his 2011 article, to look at individually what each person thinks of their life, of who they are, of what they want out of life, of what their hopes and dreams are, where they think they're going. I find it useful, even before I start to consider talking to the couple together, to meet with each of them separately as well, because there may be some individual goals that need to also be highlighted. Sometimes it may be that every other week I meet with them individually, and then the in-between weeks we meet together. Or I've also worked with colleagues where maybe a gentleman works with a man and I end up working with the woman, and then the in-between times we meet together. So there's lots of variations of that. But it's important also to make sure that they've done the individual work they need to do to make the couples work as effective as it can be. So, who do they think they are? Where are they going? How will they know when they've got there? And what resources do they need? Do they feel like they're getting those resources in the relationship? And then, what do they consider is a healthy relationship? I actually have couples do this really neat exercise pretty early on. I have them actually initially do it separately. It's called the 10 Commandments of a Healthy Relationship. And what I'll have them do is separately write down what they think are the things they either admire about couples they look up to, or things that they wish were foundations for their marriage. So certain values, certain beliefs, certain expectations, things like how they solve conflict, how much time a quote-unquote healthy couple spends together and what that looks like, how communication goes, if they have similar interests or how much time. And I find that a lot of times couples tend to use similar words like they want good communication, or certain values or beliefs like trust or love or togetherness. But a lot of times they use those words and they mean something different. So it's so important every step of the way not to assume we understand a client's meaning behind things, but to let them teach us what the operational definition of each of these words means. I also highlight that self-care is an important concept. We really can't give to another when we're not filled up ourselves. So oftentimes, it's a matter of each person learning some healthy self-care as well. Identify the resources or the skills that they need. Identify behavior requests that need to be there to support their goals. So one of the approaches that we'll talk about a little bit is called the autobiographical approach. And this is by someone named Hoang, H-O-A-N-G. In 2005, he talks about how someone looks at individually the different stages of their life, the way they were from their youth through their family of origin, teenage years, young adults, and how they've changed over the year while the other person in the relationship learns to listen and be an observer and really attend to and pick up on any significant things for that person. So what Hoang says to couples is he says, I'm going to invite you to do a piece of work and session, which I call autobiographical work. It will go like this. I'll work with one of you, and in that work, you'll be writing your autobiography. While we're doing this, your partner will sit and observe as if he or she is the reader. So again, we're hitting on the communication and listening skills here. You'll write from the viewpoint of your current age as an adult looking back at the different stages of your life, revisiting your childhood and the way you were in your family of origin. You'll observe things, you'll wonder about things, and you'll contrast you now with the little you when you still lived in your family of origin. You will be asking, how was I in relationships then? And how am I in relationships now? I would, before I dive in with this approach, teach things that we'll learn about a little bit later here, like the I messages, how each person could share what it is that they're thinking, they're feeling at that stage in life that they're discussing. They could talk about what they needed, what needs were met or not, what some of the feelings are going on in connection with having or not having those things met. Another issue that oftentimes we'll see in terms of dealing with couples is looking at the role of outside people. We're talking about friends, in-laws, neighbors, and this could be their family of origin, their community, it could be others on their job, so it really include a lot of different people. One of the ways to process this is to use family genograms. If you're familiar with genograms, they're looking at the birth order, the connections, the relationships, and which people tend to have similar qualities or beliefs or struggles. So we use a lot of pictures and graphs. Photographs are a good thing that can be brought in. When we're talking about family of origin, relatives, and outside people, photographs can be very useful in some of the work we do. Why are photographs useful? Well, on the one hand, it shows us as a clinician what things the client finds meaningful. What things does that person tend to freeze in time? What memories are the things that really tend to be in the forefront? What are the places and who are the people that they tend to want to commemorate? And are there any ways that they try to re-experience these photos again? So it really helps with processing the narrative and the story. It's really helpful to us to understand how they got to this point in time. As we're looking at the roles of outside people beyond the marriage, one of the exercises that Smith suggests in her book in 2006 is an exercise called Set Your Marriage Table. If you recall, a lot of times if people have more of a traditional marriage / reception, they do some planning with who sits where and who's at the bride and groom table versus who's more distant, who's invited, who's not invited. So what she suggests is basically for the couple to get together and plan as if they were planning a wedding or event. Look at who should be included, who should not be included. So, for example, are there people that one person considers closer or more essential or whose opinions are more valued that the other partner may not want in the inner circle or may not think really need to be part of this pretend event? So when they've made this list, they need to look at placing the names on their tables. And she actually suggests the couple to first do this separately. Start with the main table, with the couple's table, with the table for the bridal shower, or the wedding. Place the couple in the center, but then spread out from there. Look at the positioning. Because sometimes the physical positioning also can be telling in terms of the psychological or emotional concerns or positions that may need to be addressed as we explore things in couples counseling. Then what we do is we facilitate them sharing their results. Any concerns they had, any differences of opinion. Are there people that really just don't belong? Maybe they're biological relatives, but they just cause too much of a divisiveness, or they're just not helpful towards the couple's goals. Are there people that one thinks really belongs and the other does not? Commonly, you know, we will see this in couples counseling, where they may have a difference of opinion. And then we can help them look at how do they resolve this. We could also look at how does this couple want to, quote, set their marriage table from here on out. The key is highlighting with a couple, as we teach all these techniques, that everything's modifiable. You can set and reset the tables. You can invite people to be closer to you, or you can distance when you need to. When there's major events, it's expected that if there's births, deaths, changes, moves, that some of this is going to change. Over time, there might be significant issues where there's difference of beliefs or values, where that may change who sits where. But she talks about every now and then, even yearly, revisiting this and talking about where the people sit, so to speak, who's important and who's valuable that you would not want to lose in terms of your support systems, and then who do we need to reevaluate in terms of relationship. Basically, it's also looking at who's going to be a support system for the couple. What is that going to look like? Can they have the same support system even? Now, like I said, one of the things is oftentimes there's tensions in the dynamic of the couple. But a lot of times it's important to teach skills individually for each person to have to check, for example, their thought patterns. I do a lot of foundational work with them and just teaching the basic tenets of cognitive behavioral methods. So helping them look at the red flags, like shoulds, if only, absolutes, and things that are real toxic. And I will work with them, as you'll see, on identifying within themselves some of these thinking errors types. It's really easy when you're counseling a couple together for them to kind of look at the other one when you're describing these thinking error types and want to point out where the other one's doing these errors and how bad it's affecting them. So I will preface teaching any of this stuff on the thinking errors by saying that we all do them, including myself. And there may be some that you find yourself more in. But as I go through and teach these, that each person is supposed to be looking just at themselves and self-evaluating. Where are they at with these thinking errors? Which ones do they tend to use most? Yeah, they might have ideas about their spouse, but it's really not useful to be the one to point those out. It's better to create an environment in which each person is learning to self-evaluate. I even suggest with couples that when there are tensions in the home and in terms of conflict management strategies, that they use these handouts. I put the thinking error types in their handouts, and they go to separate rooms and they go down each one of those items and look at, do I do this? Do I do that? During this argument, has my part been this error? Is there something I can be doing different? So let's look at what some of these thinking errors are. So we have awfulizing or catastrophizing. People who are just assuming the worst, that if such and such happens, that life's just going to turn out bad. Other people who disqualify or discount things. So we know in life that things are not usually all good all the time, nor are they all awful all the time. But some of the thinking errors that people are plagued with tend to look at things as if they are polarized, all good or all bad. They may, especially like the people who have disqualifying or discounting beliefs, believe that good things don't count. Even when they're complimented, even when positive happens in life, they may brush it off. They may have an excuse, a rationale, or reason for it. Another thinking error that people tend to be prone to commonly, is that of the all or nothing approach. You always get on my nerves. You never help around the house. We're always having this discussion. All or nothing words like always and never. Polarizing things like, you know, I'm the best wife in the world when ABC happens. Otherwise, I guess I'm just a failure. I'm the most helpful spouse, or I guess I just don't do anything right. All or nothing approaches really get into extremes. So, fact of the matter is, as I said earlier, that things are not always good, nor are they always bad. So if we can help couples learn to live in the gray areas of life and develop some flexibility and some skills for that, that can be especially helpful. Another thinking error type is a person who has such a low frustration tolerance that they believe they can't stand if certain things would happen again. So the fact of the matter is, because they're already telling themselves, if we get in another argument, I can't stand it. If this doesn't turn out my way, I won't be able to handle it anymore. It's like the self-fulfilling prophecy. They're already assuming the worst and planning for the worst, whether or not it happens. We also look at thinking error of self-doubting. We all know that there's people out there who tend to look at things as the worst. They believe they're no good, they're worthless and useless, that they're not adding any value, nothing turns out their way. Or there's people who always blaming and pointing the finger to someone else. One of the thinking errors that I find people especially susceptible to, and oftentimes it happens to be the women in the relationships, is emotional reasoning. I will mention that sometimes we tend to react to things in life as if it's a fact. It may feel very, very convincing because something keeps happening over and over and over, and it just feels in my gut like a fact, like definitely. My spouse really would rather not ever come home. Or I'm just sure the kids don't care at all about us. You know, so there's things that may feel very, very strong, but it's important to teach our clients the difference between thoughts and feelings. So emotional reasoning lets emotions overrule the facts. I feel like people are talking about me. I feel like my spouse really could care less to spend time with me. So until we have actual concrete evidence, and there's not evidence to the contrary, it's important to avoid this emotional reasoning. We also look at other thinking errors, like labeling things. I will say, especially as we progress in today's seminar, that it's dangerous to use personality descriptions and adjectives to describe each other. Whether it's a positive adjective, like you're so nice and helpful, or whether it's you're lazy and selfish. The fact is, when we use labels, it becomes a personality judgment, and they're not helpful because they create defensiveness, and they create this dialogue of what we'll call you messages, of just accusation and defensiveness. Then the other person will come back and, oh, I'm this, well, you're this. And so it really doesn't get us closer to solutions. We'll talk about the alternative to labeling being talking in terms of desired behavior and making behavior requests. And that's something we'll highlight a lot today. Mind reading is another thinking error. Assuming that because something happened a certain way, maybe before, or because it seems that way, that we know and we can predict. We have to look at all the facts and really see if the evidence is there of what we're thinking of. Another thinking error is just overgeneralizing from limited information. This can lead to stereotypes. This can lead, again, to erroneous judgments. We can personalize things that maybe have nothing to do about us as well. That my spouse might be quiet. Oh, it must mean he or she's clamming up. They don't even care about talking to me. But fact of the matter is, it might not even be a personal thing. There might be something else on their mind. Maybe they're just relaxing because they're tired from their day. There's just a lot of explanations for things. And shoulds and musts. A lot of times what people think of can be put in the form of shoulds. So what we're doing when we're doing cognitive behavioral work, either individually with each party or together, is we're assisting clients in identifying their thought errors, and we're helping them separate the reality from the error. We're also teaching cognitive debating skills. There's questions that I'll give to clients. Things like, is this a fact? Or is it just a strong opinion that feels like it might be true? Is there any other way of thinking about things? Because a lot of times, if we can think of an exception or another way, then it can't be a fact. And oftentimes, it's not just one exception we can think of. We can think of quite a few. If it's not a fact, then why am I continuing to tell myself this thing that's ruining the couple relationship? Is there another way that I can look at things that might be more useful and helpful? Is this belief life-giving or is it death-producing? And that can be looked at on several elements. Is it physically draining me? Is it causing or contributing to some health problems? Is it making me see my spouse or partner in a less than positive light? Is it emotionally taking a toll on me? Can I continue to tell myself this if it's creating that? Is there another way of looking at things? So essentially, we're helping people separate the reality from the errors. We're teaching them these cognitive debating methods. What happens is, it's not necessarily what we perceive that is the truth. Things happen, but we tell ourselves stories and reason things about them. We make assumptions. These stories are actually distortions of reality. Munoz, in a very recent 2018 article, talks about we tell ourselves rationally or irrationally in our head something about all our dynamics as a couple. He suggests that when couples are dialoguing, if we really want to get to the core of issues, we can address a few different areas. For example, the first area is, the story I make up is. Secondly, and the way that makes me feel is, blank. And finally, and when I feel that, I cope by, blank. So, for example, when someone says, my spouse is not home, he or she is late again. If they really take time to think about it, the story I make up is that they're not late because of an accident. They're late purposely. They really didn't intend to be there for me. Next one, the way it makes me feel. And the way it makes me feel is neglected, brushed aside, unimportant. The thing about this method is it helps identify the thoughts, the feelings, the concerns. And those are things we can work on. To be able to say, I perceive it this way and I feel neglected, we can end up asking for some behavior requests. In the future, I would need a phone call if you think you're going to run late. Or just a little heads up if it might be a busy night at work. When I feel neglected, betrayed, or like you don't care about coming home, I end up coping by yelling and blaming you. I end up withdrawing affection. So there are some common stories that are the ones that tend to be toxic in relationships. And, you know, we see these in our clients all the time. Things like, I'm not lovable. I'm not good enough. Everybody just leaves me. Nothing turns out my way. People always take advantage of me. My efforts mean nothing if I'm not good, right, strong, and perfect. And it's too late for such and such, whatever the desired goal is to happen for me. And it just doesn't matter how hard I try. So one of the things I would like you to do, I've included in the seminar an audio example here that we're going to listen to about I'll never be loved. Just so you can hear these automatic, negative, irrational thoughts. And in the moment, just imagine for the client how it does make sense. It feels like it's true. It feels like over and over every Friday my spouse has happened to be late. Wow, my spouse must be stopping by happy hour for a drink or to have a little time hanging out with the coworkers before he or she gets home to me. It feels like When my spouse is around, they'd rather sleep or rather withdraw to the other room than hang out with me. They don't want to do things like they used to. One of the things that I teach couples a lot when I do couples counseling is the importance of just straightforwardly asking questions. In my opinion, it seems as if when you come home, you prefer to go to the other room. Can I ask you, is that the way you're feeling? And then ask them directly and give them room for their answer. I think a lot of times we have these assumptions so built up in our heads of these common stories that I just alluded to that even if our partner really isn't thinking or acting those things, we want to put it into the story we believe. And these stories oftentimes are parts of what we call schemas, repeated ways of thinking of things in our family background, in our childhood, in other relationships. That's why we use these generalities every time this happens to me. Oh, I knew it would end up this way again. So let's take a look at this example in the video here and see if you can identify any of those cognitive behavioral messages that the person's telling themselves. And keep in mind, with the cognitive behavioral work we do with couples, there's always some truth in what they're saying, but there's also some lie. And it really doesn't matter if it's the woman or the man or who in the relationship. The common stories, you'll see a pattern that they keep coming up. And one of the things that's at the core of this that we'll talk about later through the seminar is learning to deal with vulnerability. Vulnerability oftentimes has been a negative or bad word for a lot of people. They don't like to feel vulnerable. They don't like things to be open-ended because it's fearful. They don't like to worry about things. They anticipate, their mind wanders, they go to those thought errors that we talk about. So we have to find a way to help the couples we're working with learn to feel vulnerable and be vulnerable in healthy ways. And to share that. Things like, when I am in a vulnerable situation, I feel such and such. I defend against this by, and then what's the defensive reaction? I fear, for a lot of couples, I fear being alone. I fear starting over. I fear that we keep trying, but maybe we're not meant to be. Then moving towards the need or desire and the specific behavior requests. So after we look at this video or audio of I'll Never Be Loved, then we'll kind of go on and talk a little more about this concept of vulnerability.